There is a building in McMinnville, Oregon, that gives you no warning. It sits off Highway 18, big and blue, unremarkable from the road. You could drive past it and think it was a warehouse. You walk through the door, and everything changes. The largest flying boat ever built. A wingspan of 320 feet. 8 engines hanging in nacelles the size of small cars, a hull that curves up from the museum floor like the rib cage of something prehistoric. Wooden skin, painted white, still smooth after nearly 80 years. This machine flew exactly once, for 1 minute, over Long Beach Harbor on November 2, 1947. The man at the controls was Howard Hughes. He had not told anyone he was going to do it. I'm Tail Dragger. This is the Hangar on Radio Hangar. Pull up a chair. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. The press called it the Spruce Goose, and Howard Hughes despised that name until his last breath. The wood was birch, not spruce, and it was no goose. It was a leviathan. But the press has always preferred a good rhyme over accuracy, and the name stuck. The story begins in 1942, and it begins with U-boats. By the spring of that year, German submarines were conducting what naval historians call the second happy time along the American East Coast. They were sinking Allied merchant vessels faster than the yards could build replacements. Tankers, freighters, troop ships, the sea lanes the war effort depended on were turning into a killing ground. The numbers were staggering. In the first half of 1942 alone, the Germans sent more than 3 million tons of Allied shipping to the bottom. Something had to give. A businessman named Henry Kaiser thought he had the answer. Kaiser had already built the Hoover Dam and was cranking out Liberty ships at a pace that stunned Washington. His proposal was simple and audacious. If the Germans could kill surface shipping, then bypass the surface entirely. Build a fleet of enormous flying boats. Fly the cargo and the troops across the Atlantic in hours, above the reach of any submarine. Move the supply chain into the air. Kaiser needed someone who knew how to build aircraft. He went to Howard Hughes. Was 36 years old and already a legend. He had commissioned a racing aircraft that set a land speed record of over 350 miles per hour in the mid-30s. He had flown a Lockheed 14 around the world in 1938, cutting the previous record nearly in half. He was a man with resources, with drive, and with an obsessive attention to engineering detail that his colleagues found both extraordinary and exhausting. When Hughes looked at a rivet, he saw the rivet. When he looked at an airframe, he saw every stress path through every member. The two men signed a government contract in November of 1942. 3 flying boats, each capable of carrying 750 troops or 2 M4 Sherman tanks. The government would cover the cost. Budget, $18 million. Timeline, 2 years. In retrospect, both of those numbers belong in the same category as optimistic fuel planning on a long cross-country. Technically figures not necessarily connected to reality. The design they settled on was staggering. 218 feet from nose to tail, 320 feet of wingspan, 8 Pratt & Whitney R40 360 Wasp major radials, each producing around 3,000 horsepower, swinging 4-bladed propellers nearly 17 feet across. At maximum gross weight, the aircraft would weigh close to 400,000 pounds. To put that wingspan in some kind of perspective, 3 commercial airliners parked nose to tail would fit underneath it. Wartime restrictions on aluminum forced a critical decision. Critical metal had to go to the fighters and bombers already in production. The Hercules would be built primarily from wood, birch, specifically, using a lamination technique that bonded thin sheets of veneer together with resin under heat and pressure to form the complex curves of the hull and wing structure. The result was remarkably strong, in some ways stronger than the aluminum it replaced, but it was slow to build. Every major structural component was essentially handmade. The men who built her were not assembling an aircraft on a production line, they were crafting it. Those workers spent years in the Long Beach facility. They showed up every morning to work on something nobody had ever built before, at a scale nobody had ever attempted, using techniques developed specifically for this one aircraft. Some of them stayed for the duration. Some of them had sons who served in the war. The aircraft was supposed to help win. There is something melancholy and magnificent about that. Building a machine this large, this slowly, this carefully, for a war that moved faster than the machine did. Henry Kaiser read the calendar and made a business decision. In 1944, with costs climbing, the war's outcome shifting, and completion nowhere in sight, he walked away. Left Hughes alone with the contract, the partially built aircraft, and the debt. The war in Europe ended in May of 1945. The Pacific War ended in August. The original military rationale for the Hercules was gone. The government wanted the money back. Hughes said no. He said the aircraft would fly. He poured his own money into it, month after month, refusing to let it die. By 1947, the project had consumed approximately $23 million. And the United States Senate had run entirely out of patience. The Senate Special Committee investigating wartime defense contracts had Hughes in its sights. The allegations were serious: fraud, waste, a contractor who had taken tens of millions in public money and produced no aircraft of any military value. Senator Owen Brewster of Maine, who led the relevant subcommittee, pressed the case hard. It is worth noting that Brewster was closely aligned with Pan American Airways, which was in direct commercial competition with Hughes in the airline business. Some of what was happening was legitimate oversight, some of it was a business rival using a government committee as a weapon. The mixture made the hearings brutal. Hughes was called to testify in Washington in August of 1947. He sat at the witness table in a dark suit, calm in front of the cameras and the reporters and the senators looking to make their careers off his failure, and he made a declaration that silenced the room. He told the committee that if the H-4 Hercules failed to fly, he would consider himself a disgrace. He would leave the country. Everything he had built, everything he had earned, everything he had staked on that wooden aircraft in the Long Beach hangar was now on the record. In front of the cameras, in front of the camera, the hearings recessed that month without resolution. Hughes flew back to California. He went to work. November 2, 1947, Long Beach Harbor, early morning. The Santa Ana winds had scoured the sky clean overnight. The harbor surface was flat and still. A crowd had gathered because word had spread that Hughes himself was going to conduct taxi tests in the completed Hercules. Journalists, photographers, newsreel cameras on the dock, engineers and technicians from the project were invited aboard. A handful of reporters were included as observers. The plan officially was taxi tests: run the aircraft at low speed across the harbor, evaluate how she handled on the water surface, no altitude, no flight, taxi tests. Hughes climbed to the flight deck. That flight deck sits roughly 30 feet above the waterline. Sitting in the captain's seat, looking out through the windscreen over the long white nose toward the open harbor, you are above the roofline of most houses on shore. He went through his checks, then he started the engines, one by one. Eight Pratt and Whitney Wasp Majors waking up in sequence, the sound carrying across the harbor. 24,000 horsepower clearing its throat on a November morning in Southern California. The first two taxi runs went as planned, down the harbor and back, low speed, everything nominal. Observers satisfied, Hughes lined up for a third run. He advanced the throttles, the hull rose onto the step as speed built, 50 knots, 60, 70, and then, without any radio call, without any warning to the crew or the observers on the dock, Howard Hughes pulled back on the yoke, the H-4 Hercules lifted off the water. 70 feet of altitude, 1 mile of distance, approximately 1 minute in the air. Then Hughes eased her back down to the harbor surface, smooth and controlled. A reporter aboard said afterward that the moment the hull separated from the water, there was almost no sensation, no lurching, no drama, just a sudden smoothness. The harbor falling away beneath them, a wooden aircraft that weighed 400,000 pounds, simply flying, the newsreel footage was on the wire by that evening. The photograph ran on front pages from coast to coast. The Senate hearings reconvened, but the momentum was broken. Howard Hughes had answered the question in the only language that mattered. Now here is the part most people don't know, because it does not fit the Howard Hughes story the way the movies tell it. After that one flight, the Hercules was towed back to her hangar. Hughes never flew her again. He never publicly explained why, but he also never walked away. For the next 29 years, from November 1947 until his death in April of 1976, Howard Hughes maintained the H-4 Hercules in working condition. He employed hundreds of workers whose entire job was that one aircraft. Climate-controlled hangar, regular engine runs, instruments calibrated, hull inspected, upholstery kept clean. He spent, estimates suggest, $1 million or more every single year on that maintenance crew, year after year for nearly three decades. Some historians believe he genuinely thought he would fly her again someday. Some believe it was stubbornness. Some think he simply could not abandon the machine he had built against every voice that told him it was impossible. Whatever the reason, when Hughes died, the Hercules was still in maintained condition, still ready. After his death, ownership passed through several hands. She sat in Long Beach for years, a tourist attraction near the Queen Mary. Then a man named Delford Smith, who had built Evergreen International Aviation, decided she deserved something better. He built a museum in McMinnville, Oregon, specifically around the Hercules. In 1992, the aircraft was disassembled, moved by barge up the coast and into the Columbia River, and reassembled inside a building designed to hold her. She has been in McMinnville ever since, the Evergreen Aviation and Space Museum. And she is something to see. I have stood underneath those engine nacelles and looked up at propeller blades taller than most people. I have walked the cargo hold, which is wide enough to park a line of cars, side by side. I have put my hand on the wooden skin and felt the grain of the birch through 80 years of paint. Whatever that aircraft cost in money and years and stubbornness, you can see where every bit of it went. The museum has a water slide that runs through part of the fuselage. I know how that sounds, but here's what I'll tell you. Because of that slide, families come and kids walk through the cargo hold, and some of them walk out knowing something they didn't know going in. That a man built this thing from wood when the experts said wood was impossible at this scale. That he stood before a Senate committee and put his whole life on a single flight. That the flight lasted 1 minute, and that 1 minute was enough. 320 feet of wingspan. 8 engines, 1 minute in the air. The record for the largest flying boat ever built has stood for nearly 80 years and nothing has come close. If you find yourself on Highway 18 in Western Oregon, stop. Whatever else is on your schedule can wait. Sources for today's segment include the Evergreen Aviation and Space Museum, Charles Barton's biography of Howard Hughes, and contemporaneous newspaper accounts from November of 1947. More at radiohanger.com. I'm Tail Dragger. Keep the shiny side up.